You're listening to All Things Cage at Waveform's WGXC 90.7 FM, radio for open ears. I'm your host, Laura Kuhn, director of the John Cage Trust, and my guest today is Renee Levine Packer, who was administrator with Lucas Foss and Alan Sapp, and co-director with Jan Williams and Morton Feldman of the Center of the Creative and Performing Arts at SUNY Buffalo, as well as a director of the Contemporary Music Festival at the California Institute of the Arts. When I first met Renee, at John Cage's recommendation, she was a director of the InterArts program at the NEA. She was also the producer of Steve Reich's multimedia opera, The Cave, and a dean at the Maryland Institute College of Art. In 2010, her book, This Life of Sounds, Evenings for New Music in Buffalo, was published by Oxford University Press, an invaluable insider chronicle of an exuberant time of artistic exploration and experimentation populated by now such legendary figures as John Cage, Morton Feldman, Lucas Foss, Cornelius Cardew, Marianne Amiche, Terry Riley, Julius Eastman, David Tudor, and many others who were part of this little-known chapter of the late 20th century musical avant-garde. This Life of Sounds received ASCAP's Deems Taylor Award for Excellence, and in 2016 it was published in a paperback edition. Her more recent book, co-edited with Mary Jane Leach, is Gay Gorilla, Julius Eastman and His Music, a collection of biographical and musical essays that was published in 2015 by the University of Rochester Press. Presently, Renee is embarking on a book about the late American philanthropist and photographer, Betty Freeman, who I had the good fortune to work with in Los Angeles during my graduate school years at UCLA. I can't think of anyone better than Renee to tackle such an enigmatic subject. Welcome to All Things Cage, Renee. It's a pleasure to have you.
Thank you, Laura.
Renee, do you, I was thinking in preparation for our conversation, how we first met. And I recall that I was going to go to a job interview, and this must have been 90, 89, 91, maybe even, with Michael Cerveris, who was at Duke University, and John Cage, who I was working with at the time, was absolutely adamant that I meet Renee. Do you recall this?
I do. I think it was more the mid-80s because I was in Washington at the National Endowment for the Arts.
That's right. You're right.
Yes. And I was delighted to talk with you. I was, of course, very honored that John had thought of me. And I'm glad that we have proceeded to have a life in this world, in this lucky world.
In a very roundabout way, the world has brought us together in very strange circumstances over and over. Anyway, in your introduction, I have told people about your books, your Buffalo book, which is the Life of Sound, which is such a marvelous resource. Tell me, just if you can briefly, is that when you met John Cage for the first time?
Oh, no. Let's see. Gosh, I think I don't even remember it. Certainly it was 1960 when I met John Cage for the first time at Tanglewood. And then later at Buffalo. So we were together in Buffalo a lot, and that started in 64 and 65.
Okay, yeah. Okay. So because you moved in very similar circles, the world that you were moving around in, and Cage in his.
Yes.
I mean, you were close to Virgil Thompson, you were close to Lucas Foss, you were close to all of the same people. I'm not surprised that you fell in love.
Oh, absolutely. It was David Tudor, of course, who came to Buffalo and was a member of the New Music Group. And then, I mean, Lucas was performing John Cage's work with the symphony, and we were performing on the Evenings for New Music concerts, the pieces of Cage, and the creative associates were very connected to him. And it just went on from there. As a matter of fact, when I left and went to CalArts and then later to the Arts Endowment, I asked John if I should go, because I was getting calls from people like Milton Babbitt saying, oh, Renee, don't go to Washington. And John Cage was at CalArts at the time. It was 1978 by this time. We'd known each other a long time and were fans, mutual fans. And he said, Renee, I think you should go and enjoy yourself. And I invited him to represent the InterArts program at one of the National Council meetings, and I.M. Pei and Martin Friedman from the Walker Arts Center absolutely jumped up after his presentation to applaud him and honor him. And I was so proud.
Lovely, lovely, lovely. Yeah. That was a nice time for him, the 70s, late 70s into the early 80s, a big time of change for him. It was when his diet began to change. He became quite slender.
Yes, and his clothing changed. Uh-huh. Yes. Uh-huh. Yes.
So true. You saw all of that. He went from his dapper, dapper self to his woodland self.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, now, you know, I'm just so excited about your new book, because Betty Freeman, as you well know, was very much a part of my life, almost by accident. Betty Freeman, for our listeners, was a photographer and a philanthropist. I'm going to let Renee really set the stage for this, but I had the very good fortune of being able to work with Betty through much of my graduate school days at UCLA. And that came about in a very funny way. And that was that Betty Freeman had instituted a series of music salons, which we'll talk about in a second, because Renee was there from the very start. And I was a guest. It was an invitation-only salon. And it was really the only thing that was happening in Los Angeles around, exclusively around new music. It was presentational. And Betty paid for the whole thing. And Franco Assetto, her second husband, cooked pasta for everybody. And so it was very convivial. And I was a guest of Nicholas Slonimsky, who was, of course, a standing invitation. And he came, and I was so taken with this that I went home, and the next day I called Betty, who I just met the night before, and said, I so wanted to be on the guest list, but I realized that these things had to, you know, they came at a price. So I wondered what I could do to help. Mm-hmm. And she gave me the guest list to manage, that it was my job to keep the guest list going, to prepare the invitations when it was time for them to go out. And I did that all through graduate school. And then I also worked with her personally. But anyway, so you remember the salons?
Oh, yes. But way before the salons, I thought maybe I would talk about when Betty met John Cage, because this was a friendship that lasted for close to four decades. And it was a thrill to them both. It was inspiring to them both. And I kind of think about it as once upon a time in the West. And Betty was about 29 years old. She had four children. She was an aspiring concert pianist. She had personal resources, and she was building an art collection. And at the time, that art collection included de Kooning and Franz Klein and others. And she was very interested in Clifford Still and so on. And at this, a little later in the early 60s, this wild and woolly genius curator came to the Pasadena Art Museum, and that was Walter Hopps, and he was very interested in the avant-garde, in the artist part, and he wanted to do a music series at the Pasadena Art Museum, and asked the brilliant Leonard Stein, who you know well, musicologist, pianist, the expert on Arnold Schoenberg, to chair a committee that would create a series that it was called Encounters, as it happens. And composers would come and speak about their work, and then there would be a performance or tapes or something. And this was 1964. They invited Betty because they knew that she was a collector and an aspiring concert pianist. So she really filled the bill.
And a philanthropist.
Just a kind of just beginning. And Judith Stark and Lawrence Martin were on this Gold Star committee, really brilliant. And in the very first season, perhaps the first concert, they decide to invite John Cage because, for one thing, Walter Hopps is very interested in Cage. By this time, Cage is 53 years old. He's had a 25-year retrospective at Town Hall. It was recorded, and Columbia Records had done that. And Betty volunteers to pick him up at the airport and take him to the dinner party before this talk. So he does that, and to make conversation in the car, she says naively to him, "Oh, I've heard this box set of your retrospective recording. I guess you've made a lot of money from that." And he says, "No, in fact, I haven't made a dime. I owe Columbia Records money because they gave me an advance, and I needed to pay for expenses connected to the recording, and so I still owe them money." Later on, she has another conversation with him, and he reveals that he and David Tudor had done a performance in a local art gallery for which a year later they had not been paid. At this point, she realizes how devastating it is for many musicians and that they really are not conversant with the business side of things, and it's very difficult. At that point, she begins making annual grants to people that she is interested in. And you mentioned Virgil Thompson. Cage received annual help for her from her for 37 years, beginning.
I know.
And in that first group was, of course, Harry Partch, who she also met through the Encounter series, and Terry Riley, who she met through the Encounter series. So Walter Hopps and Leonard Stein were huge influences on the early years of her philanthropic gestures.
Amazing. Now, remind me, though, she was still married to Stanley at this point?
Yes. She was still married to Stanley.
Wishnick?
No, Wishnick is her maiden name.
Oh, that's right. Stanley was Freeman, of course.
Yes.
So the money came from, and her family
from
came
the father.
From the father, Wishnick, and that was Wishco, right? Wasn't that
Wishco. It was a petrochemical.
Exactly. So there were gas stations. I remember still seeing them out here in the East for years. But he also, did he not? I seem to remember this, that her father, had bought up two or three square blocks of Los Angeles real estate in downtown Los Angeles. So there was also money from real estate investment in Los Angeles.
Yes, I didn't know.
I'm pretty sure that's true.
That. Uh-huh.
Yeah. So Stanley was with her still at this point.
Yes, Stanley was with her, but it was not, they had affection for one another, but it was no longer a loving marriage.
Uh-huh. And how old were the children at this point, roughly?
I think Robbie was beyond the seventh grade. So, you know, I mean, I think they were, I don't even know the terms since I don't have children.
Me neither. So they were sort of preteens.
Yeah, there were some preteens and they're just beginning early teens. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. So I remember one time, and there's probably a better time to say this, but I always remember John not correcting me, but clarifying something for me. So Stanley was her first husband, and he was very conservative, and Betty was very conservative. And then her second husband, who was the only husband I ever knew, was Franco Assetto, who was this bald, flamboyant, Italian sort of futurist artist.
Exactly right.
Who was very, very sensual. and let that fly whenever he felt like it. Betty and I, when I worked with her secretarially, we used to work in her boudoir. She had this, they shared this very large bedroom. And it became very clear to me of their relationship that this was Betty number two. This was not Stanley's Betty. This was Franco's Betty. Because there was a lot of heat in that relationship between the two of them. And Franco had even painted this painting of Betty. I wonder where this went. It was a painting of Betty like the, there's a famous poster that came out of a young model who was lying on her side naked with a python wrapped around her. Do you remember?
Oh, yes.
I can't remember who it is, but anyway, it was a picture like that, except Betty's back was to the artist who was painting her. It was Franco. And she had her, but she was nude, but she had her hand across her behind to the back with a huge flower coming out of her hand. So she had this big, like a chrysanthemum or something across her bottom. Mm. I always remember when I would look at this picture thinking, that this was a different Betty, I'm quite sure. And I mentioned this to John once, something about, I wonder she must have changed so much when she and Franco got married, to which Cage said something like, oh, Laura, for heaven's sakes, Franco would never have been interested in Stanley's Betty, that Betty had done her own transition into this much more open, social, sensual character. And that's what Franco was attracted to. Do you remember the first Betty?
No, but reading so much for the book that I have been working on, I do feel her. She was a friend of mine, but those early years, she really practiced the piano 6 to 8 hours a day. Now, if you have four children and you're practicing the piano, and Robbie, the oldest son, told me that she used to take him to the dentist, take him to the flute lessons and all this as well. I don't know how she really did it, except that she had help. But she was maybe hiding out, 6 to 8 hours a day. You're pulling yourself out of circulation, really, by doing that. And then she had an art collection that she was amassing. I mean, I just don't know how she did it all, except to pull herself away.
Right. When did she move to Los Angeles?
They moved to LA. She and Stanley from, I guess, Boston in 1950. And they rented a house from Lee J. Cobb and then moved in to the Hillcrest house where she lived until she died in 1952. And what is remarkable to me is that the friendship that she created with John Cage and with Harry Partch, who she supported to the end of his life, which was 10 years after she met him, and so many of the other composers as we go along that she came to know, the remarkable value she placed on the friendship with these wonderful people. And like you, I have to say they were mainly men. She liked to be with men, and she was inspired by them, and she was interested in what they did, and she was enthralled with original creativity, a real originality such that we think of a Clifford Still or Joseph Cornell, a Harry Partch, or John Cage. These are the people that she was just drawn to.
It's true. Was it Clifford Still that she studied with as a photographer?
No, she studied with Ansel Adams
a little bit. That's right.
Yeah, she took a workshop or two with him, Then other photographers as well. And that happened after she was during the period she was producing a film on Harry Partch, and someone asked her while she was watching the proceedings to take some still photographs and told her how to handle a camera, which she didn't know. And then she got hooked. And from then on, she started taking portraits of composers. Yes. And then began showing those portraits in gallery shows called Music People.
I remember I did. Yeah. I actually was the person who did her, what do you call the, like little photo tags? You know, the things that were in
the captions.
Yes, the little captions. I did those for her first show.
Oh, was that at Otis Parsons?
At Otis Parsons in New York.
Mid-80s, the time of the Cultural Olympics.
That's right. It was like 84. Yeah. I think it was 84. Might have been 82.
It was. No, you're right. It was 84.
Yeah. No, I remember it vividly. And I remember her photography from the salons. There's a picture of me, actually. And Franz van Rossum. Do you remember Franz?
I certainly do. As a matter of fact, I have a wonderful paper called John Cage Observed that Franz van Rossum gave, he and his friend Abby Scherer gave to, and somehow I got it, at a concert recently. It's in Santa Monica. Abby Scherer brought it to me, and it's an unpublished kind of essay that Betty wrote called John Cage Observed.
Oh my God, you should send us a copy, Renee, for the archives.
We won't
circulate it. You know, we won't circulate it social media wise, but it would be nice to have it here. Thinking about the salons, I really meant what I said before, that there was really, for new music people, which I was, there was really nothing like it in Los Angeles. It was such an honor to be able to attend these. They were monthly, they were free. They were so gracious. The whole thing was so gracious. And we learned everything we needed to know. You know, she brought in all the right people, all the most interesting characters. It's the first time I ever heard Steve Reich was at her house. It just goes on from there.
Well, I have to say that we must also credit the music critic Alan Rich for that, because he co-hosted all these musicales, and they lasted for 10 years. And they constructed the list of invitees together. I think that it became a very personal mission of theirs to do this. And I know that Betty was a little irritated that the film world, the movie people weren't involved as much as they should have been. All those resources, it's kind of amazing that there were very few people from the film world who were interested.
Welcome to Los Angeles. Welcome to Los Angeles. Never the twain shall meet.
Well, I'm going to a program here in La Jolla, the La Jolla Summerfest coming up, about film music and a lot of the emigres from Europe who came during the war, like Korngold and others, are going to be performed. It seems to me Alfred Hitchcock had a really good ear. And this guy Herman, who wrote the score for Psycho, is going to be represented in a
I was just going to hum a little bit of the shower scene for you.
But the shower music. right.
I fell in love with Los Angeles. I'm sort of a native. My parents were born there, both of them. And both of my grandmothers spent their lives there. But I really fell in love with, when I went there for graduate school, because I was born in San Francisco. So I'm a Northern kid in California, but I went and did all my graduate studies at UCLA, both a master's degree and a PhD. And I immersed myself in Los Angeles history. I mean, I just fell in love with the emergence of this city out of the desert. You know, Carrie McWilliams, The Island on the Land, that book, if you haven't read it, it's absolutely a must read. And the whole history of, working with Slonimsky as I did, and being around him, being around Frank Zappa, being around this underbelly of Los Angeles was really an honor. And Betty fit right into that in the most wonderful way, because she wasn't unknown. Do you know what I mean? She wasn't hidden. this was not a person who was hidden. It was just, she was eccentric. There's no question about that. She was an eccentric soul, but she fit as if she were a flower there, as if she were born there. You know what I mean?
Yes.
She just fit in.
It's true. She had a very good friend, Sheila Tepper, and Sheila tells me the story about the first time she saw Betty. They were going to an opening at the Los Angeles County Museum of Art, and they went up an escalator, and she found herself behind a beautiful woman, immaculately groomed in designer clothes and gorgeous legs. And she said it turned out to be Betty.
Right.
And she did have that wonderful aspect about her.
Yeah. She was quite amazing. I asked her once, that's funny that you should mention that Sheila remarked about her legs, because I remember walking behind Betty up, I think it was in her house, from the basement upstairs, walking behind her and admiring her calves. She had the most shapely calves, and asking her if she ever danced as a young girl, you know. And I remember her laughing like a young girl, you know, kind of say, oh, Laura.
There was a very girlish aspect about her. And a lot of people who I've interviewed for the book that I'm hoping to get finished about Betty, a lot of people have mentioned that girlish aspect.
Yeah, it's absolutely true. I worked for Betty, and then I was leaving because I went to work for John, and I was leaving Los Angeles, and I brought in a friend of mine, Dina Clem was her name at the time. She's now Dina Ormeni and still in Los Angeles, but she came and worked for Betty after I left. And she insisted that Dina go get contact lenses, because Dina wore glasses. And Betty was of the opinion that men didn't look at women who wore glasses. And she had this strange brush of personalities, you know, this kind of very old fashioned ideas in the city of the modern world, Los Angeles, you know. And at the same time, she was very old fashioned with these ideas.
Yes,
and she paid for the optometrist to give Dina contact lenses.
That's right, Anish, but she also had such a commitment to the avant-garde. She did say, I am interested in the new, and she was talking about whether it was clothing, whether it was decor, her home, whether it was art, music, and she said, I just don't understand why everybody isn't interested in the new.
Right, she was.
She couldn't have been it.
Yeah.
But she was also kind of refreshing in the sense that she was modest. We can talk for a minute about the Freeman Etudes, for instance. When John sent her one of his express note forms.
Notograms. They were called notograms.
Yes, and he used to send those around a lot. And he sent her one saying he was dedicating his new work to her, and he was going to call it the Freeman Etudes. And this was 1977. By this time, they'd had, you know, so many meetings together, dinners, lunches, trips. They went all over together. And she said, oh, no. She said, I don't want to be known. Couldn't you call it something Etude for BF or something like that? And he said, well, he said, if you don't want it, I'm going to dedicate it to Thoreau. And she thought, oh my goodness, this is my one chance of immortality.
Right.
And she said, oh no. Actually, it's fine. I'm thrilled. I'm honored. Thank you, John.
She, you know, this came up like years later, where somebody was writing about it was a program note in something at probably one of the new music concerts at the LA Phil. And somebody had written in the program notes that the Freeman Etudes was a commission from Betty Freeman. And she was so furious with this. And she wrote a letter to the LA Times because she said that she did not commission that work.
She had nothing to do with it.
Exactly. That was a gift. That was just a gift from Cage. It meant everything to her. Everything.
It really did.
And, you know, for our listeners, to make sure that people don't get the wrong idea about Betty, She was moneyed. She was generous. She was modest. She was eccentric. She was all of those things. But her home was very simple. She lived in Beverly Hills. We used to jokingly say that she lived in the poor part of town. She, you know, we would say, oh, yes, it's in Beverly Hills, but the poor side. Because Beverly Hills, as people who in California know, is divided by Sunset Boulevard. Just like the movie, Sunset Boulevard runs and separates the wealthy part of Beverly Hills and the poor part of Beverly Hills. And Betty was absolutely in the poor part.
Well, there was certainly no circular driveway. You got out
That's
of your
right.
car, walked up a path, and you were at her house. And she had this wonderful designer, very influenced by the British kind of yay, yay kind of movement. And it was beautiful, modern, very original setting.
Yeah, a lot of glass, a lot of lawn. And the swimming pool, I always remember Franco Assetto, her husband. He would make these candies. They look like Christmas candy, like ribbon. I think it's called ribbon candy. And they would float in the swimming pool like little rafts, you know, but they were small. It was all these kind of this traditional kind of house with a hockney hanging outside by the swimming pool. And Franco Assetto little ribbon candies floating around in the water and pool. She was quite something.
Yeah, she was. She was very inspired by Kate. And in this paper that I was given, this John Cage Observed, she writes that John Cage touched my life and made it richer in a number of ways. He showed me that it's only what you give that comes back to you. He stimulated me with the book Silence. He inspired me with his self-disciplined work habits. He was somebody that she admired for so many reasons. And she just said it was impossible not to love John Cage.
I think that's true. I mean, I personally think that's true.
One of the touching things that I've come across in my research, which has been at the Special Collections at the University of California, San Diego, is one of those notes that he sent to, that John sent to Betty. And he writes, "One of the great pleasures of my life is our friendship." And I thought that was so beautiful. He wrote it in 1989, 3 years before he died. And it was just a beautiful find.
Yeah, they were close, although they didn't see each other much. You know, I'm going to tell you a really beautiful story that I think probably kind of fed into this. It was when she had, I think it was her first photo show. No, it was the photo show at BAM. Of her work, of Music People. And there was a private party associated with it. And John and Merce were going, of course. And John and I were working together. And he said, come over at 5 o'clock and we'll get a car service together and go. And I said, okay. And Betty called me later that afternoon to tell me that I wasn't invited, that there was a limited number of guests that the space could hold. It was a private party, maybe even at one of her son's houses or apartment in New York. And so I was in this terrible position of, you know, having to tell John that I wasn't going to be there. So he and Merce should just go. And John said, what do you mean? And finally, I just said, you know, that Betty has asked me not to go because space is limited. And John said, then I'm not going. I won't go, John said, so you go. You can have my place and I'll call Betty and tell her.
Oh my goodness.
It was terrible. The whole thing was terrible. And Betty ended up, the end of the story, you know, it ended up fine in the end. We were still friends. We still, you know, communicated. I visited with her when I was in Los Angeles, but she ended up pleading with me to go, that the whole situation was untenable for her. that she couldn't have John not go so I could go. And it was untenable for me because I said, I'm not going if John's not going. I'm not taking his place. And she said, Laura, dear, you have to. You have to go with John. You have to. And so I did, and it was all fine. But it was, that was an example of John saying, you know, no, take my place. You take my place. You go. Another time, he was so sweet. Another time we were absolutely cleaning house because he was cooking a birthday party, a surprise dinner for his good friend, Minna Daniel, who was, I think, turning 90 or something. And we were cleaning out the house. It was like spring cleaning galore. And we pulled all the stuff out of the closets, including all these old clothes that he never wore. And I said, okay, I'm going to bag those up for Goodwill. And he said, what? And I said, for Goodwill. And he said, he looked so forlorn. And I said, why? What? You don't want me to take these to Goodwill? And he said, no. You can take those, but you have to take my better things too.
Oh.
Yeah. He said, you can't give away your old stuff. You have to give your new things.
Yes.
He was so happy about his new shoes, you know. And I said, you're unclear on the concept here.
Well, I have a wonderful Betty John story. When I would stay with Betty in Los Angeles, which I did from time to time, we would take early morning walks in her neighborhood, you know, about 8 o'clock. And one day we were walking and she mentioned that John Cage was coming in a few days to stay with her. And I said, oh, Betty, you mean John Cage is going to sleep in my bed? And she paused and she said, no, you're sleeping in John Cage's bed.
I could hear that coming.
It's so wonderful. I loved it. And she was right.
It was very funny.
Yeah.
Yeah, they were really close. Although, you know, she was an interesting character in the sense that I was thinking about when I left to go to New York to work with Cage, and I'll tell you two things about Betty. She gave me $500 in $100 bills, five of them. And she said, this is so that you'll go to see absolutely everything you want to see when you're in New York. Don't hold back. But one of them is for you to safety pin to the inside of your bra. And I said, what? And she said, anytime you go out alone, you safety pin that $100 bill inside of your bra, because if you get mugged, you just give that to them and then they'll leave you alone.
Unbelievable. Did she really say that?
Yes. Now, did I do it? No. But you know, I thought, well, she may be onto something. I don't know, you know.
Yeah.
And you remember when were you around when she had her accident in Turin?
No, she told me about it.
Yeah.
And it was so dreadful. And I did call her in the hospital, of which she had no recollection whatsoever.
Yeah. For our listening audience, Betty was visiting her, Franco, her second husband, was from Turin. And she was visiting with Franco and she was crossing a street and got hit by a car. And was medevaced to Los Angeles to the hospital and had no memory of any of it. No memory of being hit by the car, no memory at all. And I can tell you that she had me in that hospital room on the third day of her arrival, taking shorthand.
Really?
Just sitting on her hospital bed.
Now that I didn't know.
Yeah. She was quite something. You know, Renee, I should tell you that if I haven't, that there have been attempts over the last, I would say 5-6 years to publish the proceedings of the musicals.
Yes.
There was, I forget the fellow's name who was doing it, but that didn't come to pass. And the transcript ended up with Mark Swed.
Oh,
the critic, and I now have a copy of it. because Mark asked me if I would work with him to put it into publication shape. And I said, yes, of course. And then Mark just faded out of the project. It just never came to be. But maybe you'd like to take a look at those materials.
I think so. But of course I would. And I should tell you, I've talked at length with Mark Swett. Uh-huh. So he, and I've interviewed him and so on. He knows what I'm up
okay,
to.
Okay, good. So you probably have it from the horse's mouth.
And I, but there is another person, and I can't think of his name right now, who has been working on a book about Betty's music halls.
Let me see if I can find it.
That may be the guy. He's got a, what do you call those? I don't know the word, the technological word. A thumb drive of all the music halls that Alan Rich gave him. So he's got.
I'm looking this up right now to see if this person's name is in here. It probably is. We can talk about this later, but it just struck me. I never mentioned this to you.
Yeah.
But I have the whole book.
Helpful. Yeah.
I'll send it to you.
And there's this wonderful Steve Lacoste at the, as a matter of fact, that was your, I think your idea that I should go to the archives at the Los Angeles Philharmonic, which I have done and spent a good many days with Steve Lacoste, who's now retired from the Phil. He was just an invaluable help. And he's given me a good deal of the music hall information.
Marvelous.
Thank you for that, Laura, because
it may be duplicated, Renee. It may be the same materials, but these materials are intact and protected. So at some point they're going to come out. Maybe we can get Mark to refocus and do this in tandem with your book.
That would be great.
Wouldn't that be wonderful?
Yeah.
Do you have a publication date?
No, I don't have it. I don't even have it in shape yet.
Okay.
Because I've had this horrible interim year. And so it's not in shape yet. And as you know, I've been thinking and working also as it should be a double. It's also about Nika Panonica Rothschild, who was the patron.
Oh, that's right. That's right. Yeah. You did talk to me about that a little bit.
Yeah. So I've been working on the two of them.
Marvelous. We're going to have to end in about 2 minutes. Is there anything that you would like to bring to the table quickly before we have to move on?
I don't think so. I just feel that it's interesting that these a person as well-to-do as Betty Freeman and many other art patrons that I have known find such joy in working alongside artists and how inspiring they are. And that's something that I think is under-discussed, how much the patron gets in return. And specifically in music, where there's no possibility of a payoff of early recognition of a canvas, and you can sell it later and all that stuff. But particularly in music and these patrons of composers and how special they are.
Yeah.
I think that's really important.
Yeah. So I know she enriched my life enormously and all of the people around me. And really gave an LA presence to so many people who wouldn't otherwise have been seen or heard, not for, you know, decades to come. So thank you, Renee. Thank you for your work.
My pleasure. Thank you.
All right. We're going to move on. I'm going to bid you adieu, Renee, and I'll introduce Freeman Etudes, and we'll listen to a bit of that in a moment. John Cage's Freeman Etudes for Solo Violin, composed between 1977 and 1990, comprises four books, each containing eight etudes. Cage used tracings of star charts to determine rhythm and pitch, and I-Ching chance operations for all other parameters, for example, bowing style, dynamics, durations, microtones, etc. The etudes are written in an extremely detailed way, with nearly every aspect of sound and sound production specified for each and every note. Thus, they are extremely difficult to perform. In performing them, Cage also asked that the player play as fast as possible, in compliance with the dictum behind the composition, which is to say the practicality of the impossible. The first 16 etudes were composed in collaboration with Paul Zukofsky during the years 1977 to 1980. Cage left them unfinished for 9 years, but after hearing a performance of them by Irvine Arditi, he continued his work in 1989-90, assisted by James Pritchett, who reconstructed the compositional process from Cage's notes and worksheets. Notable performers of the Freeman Etudes have included Paul Zukofsky, Janos Negishi, and Irvine Arditi, in that order. We'll listen this evening to an excerpt from Arditi's recording of Book 1, released on Mode Records as Mode 32, Cage Edition 7. Here's a bit of what Brian Brandt had to say about this amazing piece and recording of it. John Cage's Freeman Etudes are the modern equivalent of Paganini's virtuoso solo violin etudes. Each etude is completely notated down to the smallest detail, and, as the composer states, are intentionally as difficult as I can make them. So I think that this music, which is almost impossible, gives an instance of the practicality of the impossible. The detail and complexity of these etudes give them a unique and unusual spot in Cage's oeuvre. The first two books of the Freeman Etudes were composed between 1977 and 1980 with the help of Paul Zukofsky, who answered Cage's questions about what was and wasn't possible to play on the violin. Cage also composed the 17th etude in 1980, but abandoned writing the remaining 15. The work was abandoned until 1990, that is, after Cage heard Irvine Arditi's remarkable rendition of the first 16 etudes, presumably in London at the 8th Almeida Festival of Contemporary Music and Performance. Buoyed by Arditi's facility with the work, Cage once again had inspiration and impetus to complete the last two books, which Arditi would go on to record for Mode. While portions of the first books of the Freeman Etudes were frequently performed over the years, most often by Paul Zukofsky, the work was premiered in its totality in Zurich by Irvine Arditi on June 29, 1991, at the Junus Fest Volkens James Joyce John Cage Festival, initiated by Werner Bertschi. One goal of the etudes was to make each one the same duration, as fast as one can play the most difficult etude with accuracy. Arditi's performances are at blistering speed and center right around 3 minutes each, far faster than any other recorded version. Mode had the great pleasure to record books 1 and 2 of the etudes under Cage's extremely pleased and helpful supervision. The booklet contains photos from the recording session, and liner notes were included by James Pritchett, who helped Cage go on to complete books 3 and 4. As to Irvine Arditi, in addition to his phenomenal career as first violinist of the Arditi Quartet, Arditi is an extraordinary soloist. Born in London in 1953, he began his studies at the Royal Academy of Music at the age of 16. He joined the London Symphony Orchestra in 1976, and after 2 years, at the age of 25, became its co-concert master. Arditi has given the world premieres of a plethora of large-scale works written especially for him. These include compositions by Zanakis, Toshio Hosokawa, Brian Ferneyhough, Luca Francesconi, James Dillon, and Jonathan Harvey. He has appeared with such distinguished orchestras as the BBC Symphony, Berlin Radio Symphony, Royal Concertgebouw, Moscow Philharmonic, Rotterdam Philharmonic, Munich Philharmonic, Junge Deutsche Philharmonie, and the Orchestra Nationale. Thus, as well as having recorded over 100 CDs with the Arditi Quartet, Irvine Arditi has an impressive catalog of solo recordings, several award-winning. His recording of Cage's Freeman Etudes as part of his complete Cage Violin Music Series for Mode Records has made musical history. Here are the first three etudes from Book One. Thank you.
Thank you.